You're listening to The Impromptu on the Hologram Radio Network, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. I'm Alex Knight, and I'm joined by Michael Norton, Chief Creative Officer. And today we have a special guest in the studio, Matthew Dean. Hello and welcome, Matthew.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Why don't you tell the fine listeners who the hell you are?
I am the number one web developer in Vancouver.
Well, that's an awfully bold claim.
I challenge you, sir.
Can you back that up?
I am the head nerd of Vancouver in web development. No, that's my field, but I've worked on some different projects. I'm one of the maintainers of LESS, the CSS pre-processing language.
Oh, really? Wow, that is fantastic. So you're a celebrity.
Yeah, yes.
Yes.
I'm a celebrity in the open source circles. One maintainer.
He has unlimited power.
I have the ability to slightly make changes and fix bugs in LESS. And I'm also the developer of Crunch, an app.
I've heard much about this app. I've not personally used it, but
you should.
I hear good things about it.
It's good. It's an app for web developers. It's basically a compiler and editor mixed in one. So you can edit your languages and then save them as the compiled versions. So you can like edit a LESS file and save it as a CSS file.
Without
installing like compiling tools or stuff like that.
And is this a multi-platform app or is this a Mac app?
Yes, it is multi-platform. It is across Windows, Mac, and Linux.
And are they? Is it a native app or using some kind of web-based technology? Is it a Node.js app?
Yes.
yes to all of those things.
Based on Node. It was called the Node WebKit project. Now it's called NWJS. So it's basically I don't know how much you nerd out on this show.
We nerd out a lot, so feel free to let your nerd flag fly.
It's the Chromium engine, which, as you know, is basically the underpinnings of the Google Chrome browser. So it's Chromium, and then that's blended with Node, which is the server-side JavaScript platform. And so those technologies together allow you to build apps. Basically, so the Chrome piece is, you know, and all your web stack is to do the front-end app interface, and then with Node, you can install all sorts of Node libraries to actually build functionality into the app. So it distributes a Node Chromium package essentially to the platforms, and then it essentially runs as a web app within that package.
It's interesting. It's something that I looked at not too long ago, and I haven't seen a lot of apps actually adopt that, or at least that they haven't actually advertised it, and maybe that's the thing. But is it something that's had a slow uptick as far as developer adoption is concerned?
It's had a lot of dead ends because for whatever reason, no one's been able to really popularize it. It's a good concept at its core because basically your app runs anywhere as a native. I mean, the people are more familiar with PhoneGap, which is essentially the mobile version of the same concept. So all they're doing is they're doing the desktop version of PhoneGap. So you're writing a web app. It has certain API hooks that, you know, link you to like file access or, you know, system notifications and shit like that, creating menus, creating native menus. So there's a lot of native hooks into the underlying system, but then you're building that as a web app on top. Adobe tried to do this for a while with Adobe Air.
Which was awful.
It was cutting edge at the time, sort of like, you know,
resource hog. I mean, I don't think any Mac users enjoyed the actual experience on it.
Well, the problem is they got iOS religion. So they had started to develop the web platform, and at the first release, it was Flash and web, but they were actually promoting the website more. And then Adobe Marketing stepped in and they started saying, well, we need to, Flash is dying, so we need to build up Flash. So they started, then they branded it as part of the Adobe Flash platform. So essentially they no longer developed the website and they abandoned all the web developers for Adobe Air. And then what they did is they jumped into mobile development. And then they said, well, let's take your Adobe Air apps and compile them to the web. And then it just became a confusing, schizophrenic mess. So they basically created a product which would fail at everything. So it did desktop poorly, and it did mobile poorly.
Really can't make that up. I mean, is there, they yeah. should get an award for that.
Yes. So everyone abandoned Adobe Air on desktop because they abandoned it on desktop. And then a few other projects have tried to pick it up over the years.
Yeah.
And so NWJS has gotten some traction, but they're not big marketing guys, yeah. And the name kind of sucks.
Yeah, though they do have probably a more well-known competitor, Electron,
yeah.
which is built by GitHub. They used it to build their open source editor, Atom. It basically is exactly the same thing, just with better branding.
That is exactly right. And it's and the technology and the way they implement it is not even necessarily better.
No.
But it's GitHub,
it's different.
And it's got better
yeah.
branding.
And it's... the Slack app actually uses Electron.
Oh, does it?
Yeah.
Okay. I was actually going to ask about Slack because now, granted, I have a bit of an older Mac here, but I know I'm not alone that a lot of people have complaints about the performance of the desktop app because to me, I mean, it's not a native Mac app. It's not...
No,
it just feels like a web wrapper, basically.
It's essentially the Slack web app put into an Electron shell.
Well, if you log on, I mean, if you go in through the web interface, it's the exact
yeah.
same experience. And that's been a common complaint. And my argument is basically that they should hire me because it's not necessary. Like performance doesn't have to be related to, you know, because it's JavaScript essentially.
Yeah.
They're making a number of trade-offs, and probably those trade-offs are for cross-platform compatibility
right.
because it's essentially the same one that runs in the browser.
Right.
So then they need to make it work in
right, cause now
environments
they have,
like IE9.
And, yeah, now they have an Android app too, so they've been branching out to all these platforms. I think Slack even has a Windows app. So
they do, yeah.
So they have to kind of be everywhere, which is obviously poses its own challenges.
Yeah. Yeah. They could make it more performant, and that really takes, that's all the engineering side of things.
Yeah.
It's nothing inherent. I mean, like in theory, your native compiled app can run faster, but the fact is now that Google Chrome's, V8 engine is so efficient, that, you know, you get their just in time compiler is essentially fast enough.
Right.
You know, it shouldn't really make that
yeah.
big of a difference. Like, basically, there's the initial start time, which might be slightly longer, but the computers are fast enough. Their compiler is fast enough that it doesn't really have to be native. It's all on the engineering side.
Yeah. So probably what they need to do, I don't know if they do this yet or... but they really just need to make a branch that's like, this is the app, but... specifically for Electron, where they ditch all the cross-browser stuff. They optimize it specifically for Chromium. And then...
Oh, like a custom build of Chromium?
Yeah. So, like, they custom tailor the app, a version of the app, specifically for the Electron shell so that it runs more efficiently across...
I think NWJS does that, and I think that's why it actually runs slightly more efficient. And that may be part of the problem too, is they actually do a custom build of Chromium that cuts out a lot of the stuff that's irrelevant, like Flash support and PDF support and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So from what I know, I think their integration is a little better. So I don't know if that has anything
could
to do
be.
With it.
I mean, it's hard to know without knowing exactly what their stack is, but
yeah. It's all very complicated.
Yeah.
The odd thing to me is that when I use the web app for Slack, like it just in Safari, it feels more responsive, just like switching teams, going into preferences, looking up a team directory. Like, it's less laggy in Safari, and it doesn't feel great in the Mac app. It feels like it's not even GPU accelerated.
Part of that could be optimizations that Apple's made specifically to Safari.
In Safari, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Because they designed it to be way faster.
Sure.
There's things that Safari does better than Chrome, and then Chrome does better than Safari. And sometimes you accidentally hit on one of those, you know, like if they design it in a certain way.
Yeah.
They probably didn't anticipate it like this, but
yeah.
But it just ends up being like, you know, maybe the way that they're doing their view rendering or whatever happens to be faster in Safari with whatever their method is.
And of course, it's only going to get faster because you just get browser updates from your OS manufacturer, and in that as they ratchet up.
That's why everyone is invested in JavaScript now. Like it used to be this huge joke. JavaScript's horrible and it's such a primitive, but now
it's so ubiquitous that if you literally were to disable JavaScript in your browser, most websites don't work.
Yeah.
Well, and everyone has money in it now. I mean, once Google Chrome got into the game and started really seriously investing in web apps just so they could push advertising because they're essentially an advertising company, and then they, you know, built a browser so that they could push their apps, so they could push their advertising.
And then they built an operating system
so they
using
could push
that
browser. Yeah, et cetera, et cetera. So now there's so much money in JavaScript development that it's almost silly to bet on anything else
right.
at this point, because there's no, I mean, even if you have like holdouts who say, well, Java is better, there's no money being invested in making the Java compiler faster. There's just like, there's some, but not nearly the scale that we're seeing, you know, like it's, you know, because the web is so ubiquitous. And if you take those technologies and start putting them elsewhere, then it just makes that even more important. And so more people are putting more money in it. And now what we're seeing, you know, like with the, with WebAssembly, is now there's serious investment on the engineering side. And so pretty soon we'll have, in what's going to seem like an epically short amount of time, you know, we'll get native performance or close enough that you can't tell the difference.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously been going that direction, and web technology in general just moves so much faster than anything on the desktop that it's inevitable that at some point we're going to reach a plateau where it's like, okay, this is good enough now that most people won't be able to tell the difference. So
the problem with Slack isn't that it's not performant enough. There's principles of design where it's not necessarily doing something as fast as possible, but almost giving the illusion that it's faster than it looks. And there's some things that Slack could be doing so that you would feel like there wasn't a delay, even if there was, essentially like switching views before you have data for that view and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of stuff that they're not like when the app first loads. I mean, there's no reason why the interface couldn't, you know, like instantly.
It's really slow to load.
But it has to load all of the interface because it actually waits until it has the data. And that's just from the engineering side. It could be a lot.
But it's a web service, though. I mean, it literally does not work without an internet connection. They have to download all this data.
In theory, but not quite.
Right.
Because of the electron.
Like, could they not cache things like,
with the electron,
like how many members are in a team
they could cache,
logged in?
They could cache the recent chat because think about what you're looking at in front of you. You have like maybe 15 messages on the screen. And you have the UI elements and their states of like how many messages are in them. That's not a lot of data.
And
you could keep that updated so that as soon as the app loaded, you could essentially load that statically and then go and retrieve data to update it, which is like how a lot of apps work. So it's really designing more advanced software principles. It's not, it doesn't really have anything to do with the web platform. But because you have The problem is you have web developers who aren't trained in some of these more advanced software concepts. I mean, it's a young industry. So, I mean, if they went to school for web development, they wouldn't have learned any of these concepts because you couldn't do them on the web at the time, you know, that they were being taught.
Sure. Like, and I'm sure schools probably can't adjust their curriculums
far behind
that quickly.
How many
does BCIT even teach Node.js?
It's actually funny you mentioned that.
I did teach a course there. But in the process, I was teaching responsive web design. And in the course of while I'm teaching it, like, I feel like an idiot because I'm like, I have to tell them, by the way, everything I'm teaching you is kind of going to be irrelevant 2 years from now. And mostly that was because of like the stuff that with Flexbox that's coming in the browser. But in general, I tell people, if you want to learn web development, you can't learn in a school university setting. Like the best you can do is learn.
You learn the essentials.
The essentials, programming concepts.
Yeah.
And not get into the nuts and bolts of it, except,
right.
I mean, initially, but you need to learn how to get that information.
But students have to know going into it that, or at least be made aware that it's like, listen, we're laying a basic groundwork, a foundation for you, but you better be prepared to be constantly reading, constantly learning, because this stuff is going to be changing so quickly.
I can't think of a faster industry. And so when a university, when they prepare their courses, they're looking at, they're sort of responding to the demand that's out there, and then they build a program over a period of time, but then they keep that course for a number of years. By the time they even make the course, they're behind, and then by the time they're teaching it 2 years later, they're even more behind. So there's no real solution. I mean, I just think you can't learn it in a university setting. You essentially have to do seminars and, you know, like tutorials and stuff like that, because you have to start from where it's at right now.
Yeah.
Just a university structure can't keep up.
Yeah.
But
it basically has to be like Treehouse or the other ones where they just constantly update the videos and the tests.
Yeah. But they can, you know, if they teach all of the basic concepts, I mean, then in programming, I mean, one of the things they could do is teach maybe a variety of programming languages and how they approach problems. You know, programming is all in the business of solving problems and solving them in a graceful way.
Yeah.
So if you have that and you know how different programming languages, I mean, every programming language has the same kind of
structures. Yeah. Well, you know, I actually wanted to, like, programming has always definitely been something I've been interested in. Like, as someone working with engineers and being a product manager, I wanted to, like, I can kind of speak the language and, I understand all the terminology involved, but, like, actually being able to, like, learn how to code is something I've been interested in. And I looked into what it would take to learn Objective-C. And I was a little frustrated that...
Which is, like, already outdated.
Yeah. Well, the thing is with BCIT, it's like they still make you learn C .NET before you can... Like, there's no way that I can actually just go and take an Objective-C course and get a degree in computer science. It just doesn't exist. And do you guys actually agree that somebody should be forced to learn C# and the basics of C before they even learn Objective-C? I mean, can't someone just go and learn Objective-C and become an app developer?
I don't. Learning C is a little bit overboard because it's pretty. Is it low level or high level?
Well, when I say C, I mean it's C-sharp.
Whichever one means it's more less friendly to as far as reading, but
closer to. Assembly.
Closer to assembly, yeah. I think that's low level.
I think, low level, because you're getting closer to the metal.
Right. I don't necessarily agree with that approach. But C#, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with, because whenever I talk to people about programming languages, and in my own experience, it's one of the best designed programming languages that there is. Like, Microsoft basically knocked it out of the park on the first try. And they did that by, you know, pulling from all of the best ideas at the time, you know, from, you know, C++ especially. It's the syntax is rock solid and it's easy to read and easy to understand. So it's a great language. And so because it's so consistent, it is a decent one to start people on. And Microsoft has amazing tools like Visual Studio and all of the IntelliSense stuff. It's, you can learn as you go when you're programming in it, because their tools are fantastic for developing.
And they just bought Xamarin, so that's going to take off big time.
And that's the one that compiles to iOS?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Android.
You start with C#
everything.
C# isn't going away, and they're still investing heavily in the language. Like, there's, it's not just the tools, they keep developing on the language side, and it's got great features. Like,
and they open sourced the C# compiler, the Roslyn compiler.
I think,
which is crazy.
I think we're going to end up with C#. And I mean, JavaScript's going to be on top. JavaScript and Swift are going to be like, essentially, you know, you're going to need one of those. And so if you're going to do a computer,
especially now that Swift has a server side component.
Oh, yeah. The stuff IBM's doing is crazy. Like, for a lot of enterprise, Swift might actually end up replacing Node.
Wow.
In a lot of cases.
Yeah.
Well, and just because it's that much more performant.
Really.
And Michael and I always geek out on Swift specifically, because Swift has all of the language design is as elegant as C#. But it's as expressive as JavaScript. And so, like, when they did that, the developer conference talk, WWDC, and all the reporters are like, what the hell is going on?
And
and they talk mostly about Swift. And you saw that presentation and you were just like, holy shit. It was like, they did everything right. Like, they applied an Apple philosophy of design to a computer language.
Yeah.
And it was just right away. Like, because it's designed in such a way that, types don't really change the way that they do in JavaScript. So it can compile very efficiently as well. So I wouldn't, it's almost too bad that Swift didn't come out a little bit in front of the curve as far as Node, because I think that's probably where we would be headed towards is doing something that was more Swift based instead of Node.
But I think we will see a replacement though.
Yeah. Right.
Because,
well, it's backed by Apple, right?
Yeah. So they've open sourced it now. There's a huge following. Like, if you look at the number of the repos with the top number of stars, Swift is at the top by far, like by a huge amount.
And there's a lot of, there is a lot of involvement in the actual community itself, like with the Swift newsletter. It's very busy.
Yeah,
a lot of people.
The Apple Swift team is probably their best developer relations team.
Oh, really?
The amount of communication they have with people on GitHub, responding to pull requests, replying in the issues.
Let's see if they can if Apple can translate that. That friendly communication to other aspects of their services.
Yeah.
Like the App Store.
Schiller, you're our only hope.
And Node doesn't even have that.
No.
Node doesn't have like a, customer experience or like developer outreach kind of program.
I don't know enough about Node.
Is there like any one specific person or team that is responsible for Node?
There's a core group of maintainers. Yeah, when it split off to IOJS, that team, when they came back and merged back into Node, my understanding is they're sort of still the core team. So they're the team that broke off and then, they're sort of running things.
Because they were fed up with Joyent running things and they were like, fine, we'll make our own Node with Blackjack and hookers. And they made IOJS.
With Blackjack and hookers?
Futurama. Bender. Anyway.
I didn't get the reference.
Anyway, so they went off and they made IOJS. And then Joyent kind of crumbled. They were like, oh, we don't really want to maintain Node anymore. Do you guys want to come back and like go off and make Node awesome? And they were like, sure, okay.
They're not they're kind of rigid though. Like if yeah. I when you file issues about Node, they're like, we know what we're doing.
Don't, yeah, it don't does feel like that things. A bit. It does feel like that you a know, bit.
So what if let's go to the consumer side of things for a sec, because what does Swift mean for consumers, basically?
Nothing.
Well, I mean, there might be some surface improvements. Basically, slightly faster apps.
Do you think it might be
more resistant to crashes.
If we were using Swift instead of JavaScript, you mean?
Well, I just mean on the native app environment front, like transitioning from Objective-C to Swift. I mean, even in Apple's own apps, like, are consumers going to see any kind of noticeable user experience improvements?
I think because the language is less convoluted and it's more self-documenting in a way, like the way that they name all of their classes and objects is just so much clearer and straightforward. I think you'll end up with apps that have fewer bugs because it's just clear to the developer what exactly they're doing. The structures are smaller. They're easier to read. So that's how it's better for the consumer. It's not like the language is faster, although maybe it compiles.
The compiler is much faster.
The compiler, I think, is faster, and they designed it to be efficient.
They literally designed it to be faster than Objective-C.
But I think even like just the side effect of having a good language that's easy for beginners, you're going to have quality apps sooner. So someone who gets into Swift now instead of Objective-C can probably give you a more solid app faster.
Right.
That has
less code, probably,
with less code, and that has fewer bugs.
Right. So ultimately, smaller app sizes, less crashes, slightly faster apps.
Yeah. How does the, Michael, we talked a little bit about it before, but it's been a while, so maybe you can refresh my memory about app slicing. How does that work? Is that related at all to Swift?
App slicing is a separate thing. It's basically a way of saying, for this particular device, this app only needs these assets. So for example, if you do app slicing, the iPhone 6S version of the app will only have iPhone 6S assets.
That's where it splits it up in the actual download.
It literally creates different builds for different devices. So for the iPad, you get all the iPad assets and none of the iPhone assets.
Which, as an aside, is actually what Microsoft is starting to do with their .NET stuff.
Yeah.
So they can do tiny little. It only includes the pieces that the app actually needs. Yeah. But,
And then, of course, that transitions into the other thing that they announced last year, which was the bytecode, which is going to allow, like, basically you submit your app and instead of storing an IPA file on the App Store, Apple actually stores the compiled, I don't think it's assembly, but close version of the app, like just the compiled, like, or pre-compiled, I don't know.
Considerably smaller file.
They basically compile it and dilute it down into just this minified, uglified thing.
And is that so they can generate the
builds? That's how they generate the builds.
So it's kind of like, it's between your source code. Yeah, it's the bytecode. It's between your source code and a finished compiled IPA file. It's something that you can still further compile to a specific platform.
So the thinking goes that if they ever decide to do Macs with an ARM chip, if a Mac App Store app is in bytecode, Apple could theoretically recompile it for ARM on the fly if it was written in Xcode and submitted to the App Store through there.
Right. So it would be instantly available.
Yeah.
Because they would be sort of...
They would just change the compile target.
They would throw in another compiling.
Yeah.
Rather than you having to update Xcode and then add that as a compile target.
Yeah,
Do you think the transition to ARM is actually something that's going to happen eventually?
I think it's something Apple is very seriously considering. I firmly believe that in Jony Ive's design lab, there are MacBooks with ARM chips in them
Well,
MacBooks
we know that. There's enough leaked information.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they try a lot of stuff that they never use.
But I think in Apple's case, being beholden to Intel is increasingly becoming a liability for them.
It's been a strain for some time now.
Like right now, they're waiting on Skylake. Skylake's been delayed multiple times.
Yeah. Is that why the Mac Pro hasn't been updated as well in like 2 years?
Yeah. They've been waiting on the new chipset. They haven't been able to release new MacBook Pros. They haven't been able to release new anything because they're waiting on those chips.
Intel's, what's their problem? Why are they?
It's not really clear. Like they're basically running into production issues,
fab issues,
other things, and ultimately it doesn't matter why. It's just that this is happening and it keeps continuing to happen. Like it's a pattern with them.
Well, I thought
it's becoming
the
increasingly difficult for them to maintain their timeline.
Don't they have continued issues with like as they continue to shrink the die with with leakage from the?
Well, we haven't gotten there yet. Mm-hmm. Once we get to, I think 6 or 5 nanometers, that's when electron leakage starts to become a problem.
So is Skylake supposed to be a die shrink, or is it the one after that?
It's the one after that.
Okay.
So Skylake is the new like it's the talk chipset. And then it gets replaced with something else.
Here's what I want to know, though. We went through all of this before. How is this different from back in the day when it was PowerPC for the Mac and before they switched to Intel and they realized that it was stupid to not be on Intel?
Well, this is really about Apple maintaining control of their own platform. It's the reason why they brought chip manufacturing for iOS devices in-house, and it's why they've invested so heavily into R&D. The A9X in the iPad Pro is now basically as powerful as a MacBook. On benchmarks, about half of the tests, it beats the Core M in the MacBook. So we're now approaching a point where the ARM chips that are designed by Apple in-house are more powerful than what Intel has to offer, at least at the low end of their laptop line. So,
and that gap's going to get smaller and smaller as these ARM chips continue to be developed by Apple.
So Apple has essentially had this incredibly aggressive trajectory over the development of their A-series chips. The power level has just spiked in a consistent line. They haven't had a tick ever. Every single chip release has been a talk where they introduce like 2 times the power every single time. It's just leapt the entire time they've been developing these chips. So, I mean, a phone only needs to be so powerful. A tablet only needs to be so powerful. So where's the end game here? Why are they making the chips so aggressively more powerful every single year? And the only answer I can think of is that eventually they want these chips to be able to replace Intel so that they can be the masters of their own destiny. They can say, look, we build all of our own hardware. We design all of our own software. It all works together 100% perfectly. And it's completely optimized across the board.
Yeah, but I think that's certainly one aspect of it. But you also have to look at all the iOS features that are driving these hardware upgrades. Like, could we even do, like 2 years ago, the picture-in-picture video support with the side-by-side app multitasking?
No.
You couldn't do that without the processing power. So the processing power has to be there in order to make those new iOS features work, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it drives feature development. Like with the added power, you're suddenly able to do way more things than you were before.
Which is why you could also say they're bricking old devices faster than ever before because they're exponentially raising their power and then they're making these features to sort of match the processing power. And, you know, like, and while they'll say an old phone is supported or an old.
Yeah. Well, they down-tune or just flat-out don't make new features available for older devices because they just can't handle.
But they're still slower.
Yeah.
Like, and I don't get, even with cutting off those features, why they can't, I don't know, make it faster, make, you know, like actually cut off enough that it's actually more efficient on that
Yeah, it's difficult to say. I mean, there's a lot of moving parts when it comes to developing everything.
Yeah,
that they
Apple
do,
doesn't want you using a 3-year-old. That's why they introduced the iOS device upgrade program in the United States, which is going to be expanding to other countries. Hopefully Canada gets that.
Yeah, so, I mean,
because once that's here, I mean, people are not going to have
you turn in your old device.
Yeah,
it's like a trade-in program. You basically lease your phone. You pay so much a month to Apple.
Oh yeah, right.
And
not
then
a trade-in program.
At the end of a year, when the new iPhone comes out, you just hand in your current phone. You get the new phone. You keep paying into it, and you keep getting new phones every year.
And yeah. Do they do that for iPads as well, or just the phones?
Just the phones right now, but they'll probably expand it in the future.
That's not a bad deal for Apple, where you indefinitely take money.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. iPhone as a service. Instead of one $700 payment every other year, it's $50 a month forever.
Well, it's tough because most consumers have a subsidized phone and they never see that price tag.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, most people, when you talk to them and tell them, like, you know, that iPhone that you have is like a $900 device. They're like, no, I would never pay that.
Yeah.
So Apple doesn't want
The thing is, contracts are becoming less prevalent.
Right.
Like, we've gone from 3-year contracts now to 2-year contracts. So the price has gone up there. But also around the world, there's a growing precedent of ditching contracts entirely and just having phones be 100% prepaid. So you see this a lot in Europe.
Well, yeah, because they don't like concept of a contract, because there's so much lock-in to that particular company. Yeah.
Exactly.
It'll never fly though here. People just do not want to pay that money.
Unless a lot of people can't
afford an $800 phone.
Unless it was a monthly amount that they're
paying. Yeah, unless it was a monthly amount.
Exactly. So this is where Apple comes in. As this trend of moving towards prepaid phones grows more prevalent, Apple comes in with this upgrade program and people go, oh, wow, I only have to pay $50 a month and then I get a new iPhone every year forever?
Do they essentially replace it if any damage happens to the phone?
That's
what Apple Care Plus is for.
Yeah, so. I'm not sure on the exact rules. I think
if you're leasing it, then
you should
get a new phone.
I think if you damage it, you have to pay for the repair, or you can keep your phone, but you have to pay like the remainder that you haven't paid off or something. Like there's a few
weird.
There's a few rules about that stuff. I haven't looked into it too extensively. But
I mean, ultimately the consumer is going to be responsible, just like any lease. I mean, if you lease a car and you damage it, you got to pay for the repair.
Yeah.
Right? So.
Yeah, I mean.
and a phone is far more important than a car.
It kind of is.
It really is for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I'm sad that's not a joke.
I know. It's like so we joke, true. But yeah, it kind of is. Especially once we move to our self-driving car as a service economy.
Mm-hmm.
Self-driving car as a service. Minority Report.
Which wasn't hinted at all.
No.
By Tim Cook.
No, Tim Cook did not at all confirm there's an Apple car when he said, it's kind of like Christmas Eve where you're waiting to see what's under the tree.
What I'm excited about is getting into an Apple car and there just being one button.
One button? There won't be any buttons. You'll just go
you wave at it.
You'll just
slide
say
your hand up.
You'll
the,
just say, "Hey
dash.
Siri,"
and there won't even
be
it. And there won't even be a steering wheel at all.
No,
you just see the demo video with Johnny Ives. Like, we had to really rethink what the essence of the vehicle was, so we decided.
Yes.
Do we really need the steering wheel?
You have to strip it all down.
I mean, we joke, but my idea for the Apple car is honestly, like, if it's self-driving, my idea is honestly that it's like four seats facing each other with like a table that's part iPad, and you just use Siri to tell the car where you want to go or use the touchscreen on it. And it's like kind of a community vehicle. Like, if you're going on a road trip with your family, you're kind of sitting there, you've got the table for like snacks and games and whatever.
That's
and you can just
out,
look
man.
Out the window and enjoy the ride. As
I have
the
a
car
feeling
drives
that it'll
you.
Be a lot less sophisticated than that.
I mean, to start with, probably to start with, probably, but
at the very least, it'll be, I'm sure they will come up from the design perspective, they will come up with something innovative.
Oh yeah.
And something clean, and they'll destroy. I mean, because everyone, like even Tesla, which is supposed to be the pinnacle of car design, has its own design
horrible.
Issues.
It's horrible on the inside. And let's just stick a giant iPad right in the center.
Car interiors, I mean, you know, unless you look at the, you know, $200,000 supercar territory, well, there isn't a lot of really breathtaking, groundbreaking design.
It's funny because even with those cars, the interior is terrible. I mean, not necessarily the upholstery, but like the onboard interface.
Sure.
The UI design on all of those cars is disgusting. Like a McLaren or a Mercedes, like the onboard systems are just
so terrible.
The worst crap you've ever seen.
Which is, the irony is you have these like brilliant designers and engineers that spend all this time, you know, in crafting this beautiful machine. And then they just hire some guy out of college to design their interface.
Yes, that's exactly what it is.
Like the car display.
Just get Jim the intern to do it.
He's used PowerPoint before.
I remember when BMW first introduced the iDrive system with the little round knob thing.
Oh, God.
And I remember
so
on Top Gear, they made fun of that so harshly because to get the car into the right mode, like Jeremy was trying to, I think, turn off he was trying to put it into sports mode and turn off the all the driver protection stuff. But it took like, they had to cut the video and then cut back, and it's like 15 minutes later and he's still like,
oh my God,
with the jog wheel going through like menu after menu after menu, like
it's
trying
like
to
the iPod
like it was bad
from hell.
They've improved it a lot, but it's still, you're right, we have a like car design car UI, we have a long way to go.
Yeah, like even Tesla, it looks like WebOS from 2006. It's like,
well, and then Apple has this knack for coming in and designing something, and then everyone goes, oh yeah, of course.
Like, yeah, yeah. Exactly.
And then everyone who's in that industry is like so embarrassed. They're just like,
and with this industry,
yeah,
we
should have done that all
with
along.
This industry especially, it's going to look even worse. Because the car has not fundamentally changed for the past 100 years.
And you're going to immediately get into your old car and you're going to be like, I don't even understand why any of this is like this. None
exactly.
of this should be here. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
Johnny Ive's just going to come in like Tony Stark and be like, here is the Jericho missile.
He's going to be like, we decided you didn't need a steering wheel. And we're going to be like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Why did nobody do this before? Are they
just
all...
Just like move out, like you have a touch finger to turn. I don't know.
Yeah.
swipe left to turn left.
Steer your car with your iPhone like James Bond in that terrible movie we'd all like to forget.
That movie was great.
Wait,
it was pretty good, actually.
The World Is Not Enough?
No, Tomorrow Never Dies.
Oh, Tomorrow Never Dies.
With Elliot Carver.
Is that one of the Pierce Brosnan films?
Yes.
Oh, that was at the tail end when he, yeah.
No, it was in the middle. It was somewhere in the middle. Okay. He was being attacked by those guys in the parking garage.
Okay.
And then he pulls out his Nokia and like flips it open.
Oh, right.
And it has the screen and the little touchpad, and he's like firing missiles. And
as far as I'm concerned, GoldenEye is the best Brosnan, James Bond film.
It pretty much is.
But
it has its flaws.
Yeah.
They all do.
They all do.
I mean, they're, yeah.
Just like...
not to be taken too seriously.
Spectre.
Cuckoo.
Spectre.
Cuckoo. Yeah, that movie. I saw that movie recently.
It's a strange villain. Yeah. But Christoph Waltz is a fantastic actor, though.
Yeah, I mean, we've gone over this before, but like, I just feel like they tried too hard to connect it to the previous films.
Oh yeah,
but didn't quite get it right.
It was like Scream 3.
I am the architect of all your pain, James.
I have done all of this.
Like, really? You just show a bunch of photos showing shit from previous movies and that makes you the master villain?
At best, he was connected to one
Sort of. Yeah. Like
the first one.
Like if he had secretly been funding Quantum the entire time or had done a bunch of other shit like lurking in the background,
yeah,
maybe I'd buy it then, but yeah. It was just like, I have done everything. really, how? How exactly?
Well, I think he was partly saying, okay, to give him some credit to the screenwriters, I think he's partly saying that because of their personal relationship, that his influence on James Bond's life is that he's been the author of his pain. So even the things that he wasn't directly involved in, he shaped his life in such a way that's
a cop out. That is such a cop out. I indirectly influenced your decision making, James.
I am the ghost author of all your pain. I am the associate publisher of all your pain.
Why don't we move on? we could talk about that movie for
getting
another
into Spookcaster.
And let's not get started on the Sam Smith song.
Yeah, what?
No. The Spectre.
What Sam Smith song?
Oh, yeah, right. It never happened. It was the Radiohead song instead.
Mm-hmm. Sam Smith.
So last week, Michael, we talked about, and for you, Matt, because you weren't here, but we talked a lot about the FBI / Apple encryption debate. And I know a lot of other shows have talked about this, so we don't have to linger too long on this. But there's been a little more information on what's been going on. But is there, maybe I'll start with you, Michael, is there anything you wanted to add to this conversation and maybe pick up where we left off
okay,
from last week?
So there have been a few developments. Basically, it turns out that the FBI completely dropped the ball on the entire thing and or possibly engineered the entire scenario so that Apple would be forced to give them a secret hack version of iOS. So essentially what happened is the attack in San Bernardino happens. The attackers destroy their phones that they were using for the attack, but then they happen to find the work phone. And the FBI contacts the health authority that the phone belonged to and got them to reset the iCloud password for the assailant's account. And so by doing that, they actually prevented the iPhone from being able to make backups, because by resetting the iCloud password, you need to re-enter the new iCloud password when you unlock your phone so that backups can continue happening. So if they hadn't reset the password, all they would have had to do was plug in the phone at the guy's house where there's a Wi-Fi network that it remembers, or like at his place of work, plug it in, just leave it there for like an hour or however long it takes to do the backup. And then
you've already said, trust this computer.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't even need to do that because it just uploads it through Wi-Fi as long as it's plugged in.
Mm-hmm.
So then they would have just had to wait, and Apple would have been able to give the FBI a gift-wrapped iCloud backup with all the data they were looking for.
Okay.
But because they asked...
How do you know this story?
Because the information basically got out.
Edward Snowden, probably.
Yeah,
he has ears everywhere.
Probably. So I think the health authority even actually confirmed that this is what happened or something.
So they didn't consult with Apple from the get-go?
No. At some point in the intervening hours, the FBI or somebody told the health authority to reset the password,
why were they wanting? Because they wanted to log into iCloud?
I'm really not sure. Maybe that was the intent, but because they didn't consult with Apple, the backup was basically prevented from ever happening again. But so the phone is completely locked out now.
Wouldn't it be doing daily backups though, anyway?
Like,
wouldn't they have a recent one?
I think the most recent one they were able to get was October 19th. Or something. It was
from
like
the computer.
It was like a week before the attack or something. So
anyway, what's nice is that the FBI came out today and said we were wrong.
No, of course not. Of course not.
Yeah, they admitted
you're
they're wrong,
me
and they're
a beautiful
gonna be,
story.
They're going to be retracting their request.
They're like,
for a backdoor.
You know what? We feel like this was an overreach, and we realized as a government agency, we should never do that.
Yeah, we should never attempt to abuse our power or force corporations to subvert the security of their customers.
What I love is when people essentially are supporting the FBI, and there's not many, but people will come out and say, well, come on, why don't you, this is, we need to fight terrorism, and we can trust them to not, you know, mess with other phones. And you're like, how, what are you basing that trust on?
Yeah.
We have the information now. We know that these are the organizations that have, you know, criminally spied on Americans.
Yeah.
And, you know, nothing's really been done about that.
And not only that, there is literally a list of over 100 devices that various law enforcement agencies, including the FBI, want unlocked.
Surprise,
so
surprise.
The minute Apple does this, you can bet everybody's going to be lining up to knock on that back door.
Yes.
He says in a euphemism.
Just like.
Oops. So
yes, that one.
It's a dangerous precedent.
Precedent. Yeah,
but Apple is apparently going to make
encryption
even. Well, they're going to things are encrypted as far as I know with iCloud backups.
From the 5S on, there it's not hackable. Anyway,
nothing's unhackable, but there are degrees of levels of security that'll make it so annoying.
But it's not software based.
No.
After the 5C.
5S.
No, the 5S and on.
Yeah,
the 5C.
Yeah.
The 5C.
Yeah, the 5C doesn't have the secure enclave with Touch ID.
So the secure enclave essentially adds a hardware layer that prevents you from being able to guess a password. It adds an 80 millisecond delay, which makes brute forcing incredibly slow.
Yep. It continually adds that for every, it adds to that every wrong
like
guess.
80 plus.
That's right.
Times
so
of
retries.
So
it's not just between each one.
Okay.
You actually increase the time every time that you're
right.
wrong.
That's right.
Nice.
It's interesting, but I mean, the whole rumor now is that, and this I can imagine this is likely going to happen, but with iCloud backups, the backups themselves are encrypted, but the problem is Apple has the key, so they could decrypt this,
which is why they're able to fulfill requests for data.
So I guess the next logical step is let the when iCloud backups happen, prompt the user to create their own key that only they have. That
or
it'll probably
the key is created
or
from your
because they don't even need to ask the user; they just store it on the chip on the device.
It could be encrypted from the source,
from the hardware. Yeah.
And then, which means you could only restore it to that phone as be the only drawback is how would you like transfer
data? Actually, how would that work if you bought a new iPhone?
I'm sure they'd have
it could be encrypted by your Apple ID password, maybe, if they wanted to maintain device-to-device backups, like when you get a new iPhone.
Well, you'd probably have to
authorize
it on both ends, and then this phone would have to decrypt it for this phone.
Maybe,
To actually transfer the data. But Apple is saying now that they essentially want to make it so that they can never decrypt.
Well, and they've long said that Tim Cook has repeatedly said that on many interviews over the last year or two.
And recent,
they don't want the key.
Yeah.
They don't want the data.
And now that this FBI mess has happened, according to sources familiar with the matter, Apple is seeking to make the next iPhone impossible for them to hack.
Yeah.
And so John Gruber and I agree that the avenue they're most
sounds
likely
like you got together for coffee.
Yeah, we just
John
mad
Gruber and I we were
we
talking
just,
the
we
other
just
day.
Mad and we were like, yeah, this is totally happening.
What did you agree on?
But his theory on the avenue that they're seeking to close with the iPhone 7 is that moving forward, updating the phone will only be possible if you unlock it.
Well, which is kind of how it is?
No. You could, for over the air, you have to unlock the phone, but you can also force an update through iTunes, even if it's locked.
Right.
So they would...
Yeah, don't you have to turn off, if you do it from iTunes, don't you have to turn off Find My Phone or something like that?
No.
But you
have to do that if you're restoring the phone.
Right. Oh, okay.
But yeah. When you connect a iOS device to a Mac, it does prompt you on the iOS device. It prompts you, do you want to trust this device?
Right. If you've already trusted it, it's... avenue of attack.
It doesn't do it every time. It doesn't ask if you want to trust it every time.
I thought I don't do it that often.
It asks you that, I think, based on certain updates. I think after you do an iOS update, it will prompt you again.
All right.
Yeah. And that's probably part of the verification.
Yeah. Like I've sometimes restored iPhones and I've just plugged them in and I'm able to do it.
Yeah.
The other thing that they're probably going to close out is DFU mode update and restore. Oh, yeah. Sorry. That's the one. If you put the phone in DFU mode, it won't ask to trust. You just plug it in and it works.
Yeah.
And then you can force the update.
And that'll be
or the restore. So they will lock.
Can you give me a favor and just point that mic at your mouse?
Sorry.
Thanks.
So I think that's the thing they'll lock out. Even if it's in DFU mode, if you attempt to update the phone, it'll make you unlock the device. Or it'll just take it out of DFU mode and go, oh, sorry, you need to update. You need to unlock. So they'll probably just kind of add an additional hardware security layer with the secure enclave where it's like, oh, you want to modify firmware? Mm-mm.
Yeah. And or then, even the hardware itself will prevent you from without doing.
So essentially they're going to essentially add a bunch of tamper proof hardware stuff. And then even they won't be able to put, a GovOS update on your phone.
And the whole industry is doing this ever since Snowden's revelations. Yeah. Like every Google with all of their servers, Yahoo, they were super pissed because they realized that part of the revelation is they had unencrypted traffic between their data centers.
Yeah.
And so their stuff was tapped into, so they changed all of their stuff to
encryption. Well,
and now everyone's pushing for, HTTPS everywhere. And so we're basically going to end up with a scenario where everyone's just going to be secure by default so that they don't have to be the ones that actually betray their own customers because, they don't agree.
It's impossible for them to do so.
You know what's interesting? Yeah. I don't know if either of you heard today that that Microsoft's official statement now is that they were actually supporting Apple and siding with Apple.
Actually,
he made a fall. You're talking about Bill Gates.
No. I'm talking about Microsoft because Bill Gates has his own opinion. I'm talking about the official Microsoft statement.
They're
supporting Apple.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So they're
going to file a lawsuit. Aren't
they? They're Microsoft filing an amicus brief on behalf of Apple.
And Facebook is
every. Well. So yeah. So
I think
this is
going to be a shitstorm for the FBI and the court. Yeah. They're all going to rally together.
Basically, it's like that scene in the Avengers where it circle pans around.
This is exactly
like that. And instead of the Avengers. It's Tim Cook, Satya Nadella, Zuckerberg.
I like how that's like the first thing that came to mind. Compare it to a fictional superhero movie.
Which Avenger is Tim Cook? Hawkeye.
Captain America. Because he's the one that's all like, we have to stand up for this.
Truth and justice.
Yeah, exactly.
And the American way.
Yeah.
If Microsoft still had Ballmer, it would be the Hulk.
Developer smartness.
Steve Ballmer would just be throwing chairs at people and sweating profusely.
That's his superpower, is a super sweat.
I guess Zuckerberg would be Hawkeye.
He'd be like shouting at people and he'd be like giant sweat stains, like pit stains.
And then Marissa, Yahoo.
Yahoo's not involved.
No.
Yahoo's
but I just included her so we can have Black.
Who cares about Yahoo?
I guess.
Yahoo's up. Yahoo's up for sale now, so nobody cares.
I have no idea what's going on with them. They're apparently trying to boot Marissa Meyer out now or something.
You can't catch a break. I mean, they've been limping along since the 90s.
They really have. So yeah, it's now going to be Apple, Microsoft, Twitter, Facebook against the FBI and the Department of Justice.
Good luck to the FBI. But, yeah.
And
they have less money.
And even better, they have the lawyers that successfully got same-sex marriage passed in the United States on their side.
Who? It's interesting where this is going to go, but
yeah.
But I have confidence, and I'm trying to be optimistic that Apple is going to win.
I'm fairly sure that they're going to win because this is a dramatic overreach. Using a law that was passed in the 1800s.
I don't think the FBI, I mean, from the bureaucratic level, I don't think they know what they're asking. I mean, I know that there's engineers below them, obviously, that know what they're asking for. But I think at the higher up, they're just like, well, we need to just make them do it. And they don't realize, you know, that they could essentially be undermining their own security structure, right? Because, I mean, like, if that, you know, code were able, you know,
gonna get out.
China is gonna get it because they get everything.
Yeah,
and so like just to have it exist and create it on a phone, it doesn't matter. Like
you gotta assume someone will get it and find a way to reverse engineer it so it works on every phone.
You gotta assume that at least, you know, a state would get a hold of it. If not, you know, like terrorism and. So I think that they're probably kind of blindsided by all of these tech companies that have stood up against them because they're like, well, we just need the data.
Yeah, you know, what do you mean you can't do it?
Yeah, from the bureaucratic level. I mean, they think of how it works. They go to some engineer and be like, is it technically possible for Apple to give us it? And they just say yes. I'm like, well, then we need to demand that Apple does it. And they just don't realize. They don't realize what they're asking for is ultimately destructive as far as a larger issue.
Yeah. Or of course, Piers Morgan don't care.
Piers Morgan made a daftly,
oh yes,
daftly bad comment. What was it? Let me just pull it up here. He said on Twitter, "Extraordinary how many geeks genuinely seem to believe Apple can't safely hack into that terrorist's iPhone if they want to. Get real."
Yes, he is certainly a technology expert.
And he is an expert on security and technology.
He's programmed many things in his time.
Yeah. Like Vulnerable Minds. Didn't.
And he also instrumented his own career failure.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
They took his own show away, didn't they?
The
Piers Morgan show doesn't exist, as far as I know.
I think so, yeah.
Was he on CNN?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. And he was too crazy?
Yeah.
But what about Donald Trump's supporters that support and all the people, including Donald Trump, who believe that Apple should, I'm going to paraphrase, but he said something like, I think
they should
Apple
open it up.
They need to open it up and give the FBI the security. Like,
he doesn't.
What does that mean?
Okay, if...
Stop talking, Donald.
If any of his supporters or, you know, the buffoon himself say anything, I mean, you can be sure that it's based on ignorance and that he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
Essentially, we should all by now say that if Donald Trump agrees with an idea, that it's probably a bad idea. He was recently endorsed by the KKK.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were like, you know, Donald Trump he's really made it safer for us, you know, to talk about, you know, persecution of European Americans, I guess is what they said. Something along those lines of the head of the KKK.
Mm-hmm.
But at least Donald Trump doesn't want to build a wall between Canada and the United States because he loves
Canada. No, we'll be building the wall. We'll be building the wall. We will get our genetically engineered beavers to make a dam across the entire border.
Go forth, beavers, and do our bidding.
And cyborg moose.
Cyborg moose?
Made by Boston Dynamics.
Yes.
After we kicked it repeatedly. Now it's mad.
It's a mad moose robot.
It's going to guard the wall.
I've told my family that if Trump... Oh, God, I don't even want to think of this scenario.
Get them out of there.
It's best not to think of it.
Get out! Get out of there!
Get out! get out.
I was thinking, go get out. I was thinking Christopher Lloyd from Search for Spock, but
do it now.
Get out of there.
That one.
Hey, that sounds like Doc Brown.
Yeah, that's in Star Trek. Christopher Lloyd was the Klingon commander in Search for Spock.
The only thing I that seems to be that. Speaking
is the computer.
Let me hear it.
10, 9,
is actually eight, a pretty
get
good
out!
Seven,
get out of there!
6, 5, 4,
Marty!
3, 2, 1,
Marty!
Oh, wow.
And it burns up in the Genesis planet.
And now
atmosphere.
Our podcast exploded.
Mm-hmm.
Well, is there anything else going on that you want to talk about?
Well,
somehow
there,
ended
there
up
is,
talking about programming for almost
I
an
know,
hour.
That was great. Yeah. There is the bevy of iPhone and iPad rumors that we can round out with. So the,
you're probably, you keep up with the rumor stuff a lot more than I do. So why don't you lead that conversation?
I am the, I don't know.
And then I will, per usual, deny that any of these things will happen.
Oh, right. Yes, of course. Except,
that's my role in our conversation.
Except for the one you agree with.
And let's not forget the one you're recently wrong about.
Yes.
Which was the 4-inch.
Which is the first one I'm going to talk about.
All right.
So the long-awaited 4-inch iPhone.
Long-awaited by me longer than you.
Yes.
Because I said that this would happen.
Yes.
And you said it would
I
not happen.
Disagreed, yes. It is happening. And it is, instead of being called the iPhone 5SE, going to be called the iPhone SE. They're dropping the 5 because the 5 is kind of confusing given that this year there will be a 6S and a 7 in play.
Why the SE?
Special edition.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the presumption.
Why don't they just call it iPhone mini?
Well, because then it would have to look like an iPhone 6 if they were going to do that. Like they would literally have to line it up next to the 6S and the 6S Plus and be like, here's the small one. But the chassis of this new iPhone is like an iPhone 5S with the little glass strips on the back. But the back of the phone has been completely rounded like the 5C.
Like the okay.
But made of metal.
Okay.
So they've like completely perfectly machined this awesome curve all along the back of the phone.
No more chamfered edges.
No. But apparently that's really difficult to do. So that's probably the most expensive part, although then there's the 6S internals in it. So I'm not sure exactly how it's supposed to be the cheapest iPhone, but apparently it's going to be.
The screen is smaller.
The screen isn't the most... Well, I'm not sure what the materials breakdown is, but I mean, it seems like it would still be a lot to manufacture.
It's the internals of a 6S?
Yes, it has the A9 chip, so it's going to have always on Siri.
How is that going to be cheap?
I know, exactly.
I'm wondering how they even fit all of that stuff in that form factor.
Well, the logic board for the A9 is quite small now.
Yeah. So, that's right. That it's mostly battery, right?
Yeah,
it'd
have
it's
a small battery.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the phone will still be thicker, so... Yeah, it's more compact, but they should still be able to fit.
Oh, the 5 or I gotta stop saying 5 because the SE is going to be most likely, or we think, the same thickness, but just with the rounded edges. Is that what's happening
on 9to5 Mac? There's actually a render that they supposedly got from a case manufacturer who got it from Apple, and it basically shows the 5S design, but everything's rounded on the back.
So can you use essentially the 5, like any 5C cases?
The 5S cases will supposedly fit.
They'll still work, even though
That's the presumption. Though I would imagine you'd want to get a more form-fitting case just because of the difference on the back. I mean, because... the existing cases are designed for like a square.
If it was
back.
But if it was really close, it'd be shitty if like they moved the volume control slightly or something.
I'm not sure if they've done that. Supposedly the power button is still at the top. There is a competing...
Which is better?
There is a... Well, if it's a smaller phone, yes. If it's a larger phone, no.
I hate where the power button is on the iPhone 6. Because every time... Here's what happens. I'm getting out my phone.
Oh, boy.
So all the... And I know all the kids can see this at home. I go to take a picture and I hold it like this.
And you take a screenshot.
I'm about to take a picture.
Sorry, that's power button.
And I turn the phone off.
Yeah, that happens to me a lot, actually.
Yeah. No, I squeeze the phone because this is the trigger and I'm holding it, so I'm squeezing it.
See,
and they put it directly across.
I try to hold it this way with the camera at the top.
And you're
so then
do
I
user
can
error.
Just, I can just do this. You're holding it wrong.
No.
You've been holding it wrong the whole time.
But I got used to doing that I had the 4S before, but you know,
yeah.
Like any ones with the power button on the top, I just got used to just squeezing it like you would a camera, like you'd hold it like that,
right.
and pushing the button, and now I just turn it off.
Yeah, it does seem a little weird, but I mean, if you're holding it like this, and you know the camera's here, you kind of want to put the lens where it's easy for your hand to steady it, kind of.
Your fingers.
Of course, no one can actually... see what's going on right now.
It's
not a video
podcast. But I don't know.
Michael and Matt are both holding
up their phones.
It might
not work for some people, but eh.
But people who own Apple products are good at visualizing.
Yes,
yes,
yes. Speaking of visualizing, am I crazy or is my phone slightly bent?
Both of you, grab this phone and just look at it.
Yeah, it is. And mine is too. I noticed.
At the top. Doesn't that look slightly
You
corrected?
Have the weak normal aluminum.
No, I know mine is because every surface it goes like this.
And I've never sat on this phone.
No.
Although I've dropped it a lot of times.
Well, that's why this bad boy is made out of Series 7000 aluminum.
It's like you blow on the iPhone 6 and it bends.
Even though they were able to put out all that propaganda about how it's not really... You can see it on this
one.
It's actually bent this way. So it goes up and then down.
Yep.
So
I see it.
Even though they said, well, that's all kind of hogwash, you know, like...
Well, it wasn't. It clearly wasn't, because they made the new phone out of aluminum that's like 3 times stronger than normal aluminum.
So, yeah, so. I noticed that at one point, and I was like, what the hell? This is actually bent.
Yeah.
And yeah, I never sat on it.
I would assume the SE will probably also be made out of Series 7000 aluminum.
Oh, you know what? It might just be the glass top, because it looks like it's coming out at the top.
Because
I've dropped this so many times. So that actually might be the problem there.
Well,
and of course, it's not under warranty, because I never bought AppleCare. But this is still an iPhone 6, and I'm going to keep this until the iPhone 7, and I didn't upgrade to the 6S, so wait for the iPhone 7 to be a bigger upgrade.
Oh, yeah.
Mine is...
Hopefully, the 7 will be pretty cool.
Hopefully, no antenna lines on the new version.
Well, if it's made out of liquid metal, like, I think it'll be... What? Nope.
Will it...
Well, like the T-1000?
I was just going to say, is it going to kill me in the middle of the night?
Possibly.
Well...
If you kick it or push it or something.
Let's just accept the fact technology is going to get there eventually where it will rise up against us.
Yeah, probably. Like those Boston Dynamics robots. They were such assholes to them.
I know. As soon as they get intelligence, like that dog robot is going to be like, fuck
they
you guys.
They keep kicking it. Oh, my God. Like, wow.
Or stealing the box away from it.
And then pushing it with the hockey stick.
And that guy and the robot's like, what the hell? Keeps reaching for it. He should have just done this.
Yeah.
Seriously.
This task is impossible if you keep impeding me.
For the audio, raising my hands in a WTF motion.
Yeah. So that's the iPhone SE.
And what about the iPad?
So the iPad, the new iPad that they're going to announce on March 15th, is not, in fact, the iPad Air 3.
It is the
iPad Pro 9.7-inch. So it'll have the exact same 4-speaker stereo design with the smart connector for a new 9.7-inch version of the smart keyboard.
Do you think the stylus will
and
be usable?
And it will support the Apple Pencil.
So the iPad Air, I guess, what about the small, did they update the smaller, the mini?
Yeah, the iPad mini is now the iPad mini 4. It has the A8 chip.
They've had the 4
Touch
for a while.
ID.
The mini 4 has been around for...
Yeah.
They got to get rid of the non... They don't have the non-Retina version.
No, they've been Retina for a while now.
Okay.
They have the mini. 2 and the 4, and the second generation was already a Retina version.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you can... But I think you can still buy the mini 2. And it's essentially like an iPad
4.
Yeah, I don't know why anyone will buy that unless they're absolutely like trying to stick to it.
Because it's cheap.
It's definitely, it's decent. Budget.
Yeah, it's a decent iPad that's cheaper. And
I think the fact that it's going to also be a Pro pretty much telegraphs that iOS 10 is going to make some pretty big changes for iPad.
Well, one would hope, at least.
Because now they have this giant iPad that looks ridiculous when you have it on the home screen.
Oh, what, you don't like all that white space between your icons, Michael?
Not really.
Can I say, even as an Apple fan, I've hated the home screen.
It's long overdue for me.
It's on the iPhone, it's endless kind screens of okay. Of icons, like, but,
well, Android's not that much better either in that regard.
Well, but you could sort of, I mean, they have their ideas of like widgets and you can sort of organize stuff a little bit different than a grid.
It's still kind of a hot mess. There really isn't a great, the only innovative solution that I personally like what Microsoft did with the Windows Tile stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's the most interesting and like it looks new to me. And the iOS home screen just looks old. I mean, it is old.
Yeah.
And but the thing is, I don't have an answer. Like, I haven't really given it much deep thought. But
I'm
like,
sure it's
what
something
is the solution
Apple,
to the design to get to fix that problem?
I'm sure it's something they've been looking at for I'm years sure now, going back and forth. Like, do we change it? What do we do?
Well, Microsoft, what they did that was you're working with a small screen device, and what they did was they actually used the space on the screen, you know, like to give little previews and, you know, like to give a bigger. Yeah.
Text bleeds over from like the edge of the screen from you can kind of see what's coming.
Yeah.
Next.
They always preview, which is like a principle of like, I mean, these are right in Apple's guidelines for the new Apple TV where it says always preview content, but they don't do it for their old. They don't do it for their old devices or for iOS.
They don't
content the way that Microsoft does.
I think we might see some of those changes bleed over. Like, I think as they move towards this paradigm of essentially having iOS on everything, there's going to be kind of some cross-pollination where things they've done on the TV, things they've done on the watch, it's all going to kind of come back and improve what's already there.
Well, yeah, like because the Apple TV design takes the navigation now a step further when you don't have great input devices and you need to express a lot of information, you know, to someone looking at the screen with like the little, you know, I think they're going to start saying, well, why don't we do that with the phone anyway?
I think so. I mean, we already have the parallax with the background as you tilt the phone. So I could see them adding similar parallax throughout the interface, similar to what the Apple TV is doing, where it's like, okay, you can kind of like glimpse content by tilting or by kind of swiping. I don't know what that would look like, but they might start bringing in some of those elements to make it a bit less flat.
And was I talking to you about this, about the possibility that that at some point you'd have an iPhone where you would have some amount of navigation without actually touching the screen. So you'd actually have a state where it's hovering above the screen.
Yeah, and then there is actually a patent for that. Apple has investigated a hover state for the touch screen.
How does that work? I haven't even looked at that.
Well, you still get some of the electrostatic charge from the finger.
It's kind of an extension.
So you can actually move stuff without physically making contact with the screen?
So you could actually have
Minority Report.
A little bit.
Well, so you could have two states. So like the way that they have like the pressing deeper and stuff like that, you could now you have the reverse concept where you could have something that's more like, you know, web interfaces where you point to stuff and then it gives you information without you tapping, which is more like an action to go into it. But, you know, like informationally, you can just kind of like move your finger around the screen.
And it's pretty much the opposite of how 3D touch works because they use this infrared layer that's just under the glass. Minute changes in it then inform the pressure. So what they would do for this method is they expand the field outward so that as your finger approaches the screen, it can detect that proximity and then affect interface changes based on that proximity.
Yeah.
It'll take some tuning probably. Like they'll have to get it just right where you're not getting false positives just by like holding the phone like with your thumb just above it, but Yeah, it could be pretty cool. Hmm. And then we can finally add hover states to websites for iPhone.
Which is going to like fuck everybody up.
Oh, God.
Just all of a sudden, they're like, oh, man, touch devices.
Now hover states work? What is this?
You got another thing to deal with.
We spent like 5 years removing hover states from things.
Well, that's what I And then people are so absolute, like, this is what it is now. And they, you know, like, people are pretty short-sighted about interfaces. Like, you know, let's just make all of the touch devices this way and all of the pointer devices this way.
Yeah.
And then you have Microsoft was the only one that had the foresight to say, maybe there's some crossover in how things work, you know, between mice
and I mean,
fingers.
The Surface with the Surface Pen, I think that actually has a hover state because as you approach the screen, a little cursor does pop up. So I think they're maybe doing something like that already.
I think you're right. I think there is. It does have some sort of sensitivity.
Yeah.
Like it puts a dot on the screen or something.
Yeah. Yeah. As it gets closer to the screen, you do see a little dot pop up. Mm. So I think their field is a little extra sensitive.
Well, and it's possible that the sensors in the iPhone could already do it with the right software.
Maybe. It's possible. I mean, they already have the hardware in there, so it would just be a matter of tweaking how it works.
Yeah, like getting the signaling to, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But, yeah. Since there will now only be an iPad Pro, I think it's pretty obvious that the software is going to change. It's going to be more like a desktop than a tablet. They're going to start adding some seriously heavy-duty productivity stuff in there. To the point where you could feasibly use an iPad instead of a MacBook for like 80% of stuff.
Typing is still such an efficient interface.
Well, that's what the smart keyboard is for, per se.
Per se. You could use the smart keyboard, per se. Yeah. I mean, it'll get there at some point.
Yeah, but I think this year is probably going to be the first big step towards that because iPad hasn't changed for so long. And now that they're basically making the two flagship iPads the exact same hardware configuration, essentially, just with two different screen sizes, it's like, well, they must be planning something for that.
Well, speaking of things that don't change, what about OS X? Nobody seems to complain about how it's. I mean, it's received a fresh coat of paint several times, but more or less, it's still the OS X that we've known since.
I think the thing 10.0. With Mac OS, and I think at some point they will rebrand it to Mac OS, lowercase m, probably just to bring it in line with everything else.
Well, I've always thought it sounds awkward for me to say OS 10 10 point whatever.
Right,
it sounds weird,
so instead you can say Mac OS 10.12.
Right. That sounds more fluid. It rolls off the tongue.
They might do that.
Yeah, they're
this
all
year.
Versions of 10 right. Is the kind of the weird part of the way
so I mean they might do that this year. I don't know, but probably at some point.
What about a touch-based, like a capacitive touch-based
MacBook? They have tried that. There have been touchscreen MacBooks that they've built.
Do you still buy the reason that, and I think Phil Schiller may have said this at some point now, that
Steve Jobs even said it.
Right. That
like your
that
arm
it's
reaching for
it's exhausting to have to constantly reach.
Nope.
But I know a lot of people that have touch-based PCs and they like it.
It's total bullshit. If you were to do all of your stuff on the screen and you're typing on there, maybe.
I mean, it's got the keyboard. You're not touching the screen all the time.
Yeah. I think the point they were trying to make is you couldn't make a touchscreen iMac,
right?
Because that would be kind of ridiculous.
Which is also,
in its current configuration, it would be stupid.
Yeah.
But if you could pivot the screen so it's like a writing desk.
I'm sure they'll do some kind of variation on what Microsoft has been doing now. Because, I mean, never say never because, I mean, look what Steve Jobs.
No, I'm not going to say
Steve Jobs famously said about the stylus that you're doing it wrong. And then they come out with a pencil.
That often gets misquoted. What he was really talking about was if the operating
system.
This
is like my defense of the screenwriters of Spectre that you're about to delve into.
Oh, God.
So what was he really saying?
The full quote, he's basically saying, if you use a stylus as the main input for mobile operating
that
system,
I agree with.
You blew it.
But this is the same argument for Gorilla Arm. If you use touch as your main input up here, you've blown it.
Yes.
But I only did this for a short time, but I was basically experimenting before I got a MacBook with using, you know, some people have this setup where they have an iPad, they have the portable keyboard that they can fold up. So you're essentially using it like a laptop.
Yeah.
And that setup is amazing. It's amazing to be able to use touch and type, because a lot of the navigation that you do is so much easier with when you're doing it with your finger.
Apple has even admitted that this is an okay thing to do with the iPad Pro and the smart keyboard.
Like switching apps, like reaching for a menu, like whatever you're doing. Is like it just takes less time to do it with your finger than to do it with a mouse.
But my point was that paradigm is you've got this angled screen that's directly perpendicular to your arms.
But
it's more comfortable than if you had a flat screen directly in front of you where you're reaching.
No, you're only doing it once in a while. Like I've gone in and used like HP has something that's like an iMac for Windows
10. Yeah, but it pivots. It pivots to like
a
writing
I use a non-pivot
desk.
One, and it doesn't matter.
I honestly, I do not see a difference. If a MacBook Pro had a touchscreen, I don't see any difference between that and having an iPad on a slant with a keyboard in front of
exactly.
it. It's the exact same
it would
form
be the
factor.
Same.
Yeah, yeah.
And
that's
I've done
why
that
everything that Apple is saying is bullshit. Like, it's just a way to basically say buy our products instead of these other ones that have.
Well,
features.
I mean, to be fair, I do agree though as having the stylus as the primary input. If it's designed for the stylus as the primary input, it's not a great solution. Obviously, Microsoft failed at that. Many times.
Everyone, and
they tried to
failed.
Do the tablet PC like 10 years ago, and it never worked.
Yeah.
But hold on. But does Apple not support using the Apple Pencil as a can't you use it on the interface? Just like can you open
then
up an
9.3
app?
Then 9.3 disabled that, and then everyone complained, and then Apple said,
"I think that
sorry, that was a mistake. We're going to add it back."
Yeah, who knows if that was intentional or not? It might have been a bug.
It might have been intentional, but
with the pencil, can you? Because I never tested it for this, but can you interact with iOS and do everything? You can with the pencil. So I can even open up an app. I can open up
It was temporarily disabled in 9.3, which caused all the fuss. But once the actual final version of 9.3
comes out. It's funny you say all the fuss, like 1% of like nerds complain, but like
everyone
consumers
with an
don't,
iPad Pro complained.
Well, consumers don't care.
Well, they were probably starting to get used to using it for everything. Like you just have it in your hand.
Right.
And
then the beta disabled it. And they're like, what do you mean I can only use this to draw things?
Probably Apple was like, oh, we shouldn't, you know, encourage people to use the stylus all the time.
Yeah, that's probably the mindset. Or they were concerned about like touch events versus pencil events, like you're touching the screen and using the pencil and it gets confused. But I don't know.
But they had to work around it.
Yeah.
Because they didn't really deal with it in a straightforward way probably to begin with.
Yeah. So they're putting it back so it will be able to control everything. I also kind of feel like maybe because 9.3 is going to be the release that comes out with the iPad Pro 9.7 inch, maybe they were doing something with the code where they were adding support for the 9.7 inch Pro and maybe it screwed up somehow and they had to try and fix it, but who knows?
But to get back to your larger point about, you know, OS 10 and essentially it's out of date. And there's no technical reason for them to not put touchscreens on all Macs. The only real reason is software. It's
right. Well,
because
OS 10 isn't optimized for
It has nothing to do with your arms gonna get tired. That's total bullshit. Like you're just gonna open an app. You're gonna want to grab something on the screen or like move a file. I mean, how much easier would it be to like to move files in like Finder or something?
And
like
and
that?
You still very well may use a mouse occasionally.
Yes, or the touchpad
or trackpad.
You know,
new
like,
Magic Trackpad is really awesome.
Yeah. So it's like, but the problem is that they have to rethink all of the interface of OS X.
And they don't really want to do that.
They don't want to do that. You know, there's a lot of, and they have to work with a lot of
Launchpad is not the solution.
No. I think, honestly, they probably would rather build iOS up until it can replace OS X. That's probably
their thinking.
Yeah,
it needs more power. Power user is not even the right term, but it needs to be able to do, like, all the stuff that I can do now on my MacBook to get work done. I need to be able to do that on an iPad Pro. Yeah. Otherwise, I can't switch.
I mean, I've always said the moment when iOS will finally be something you can replace OS X with is when Xcode is on iPad.
It's going to be it's going to take more than that. What about all the pro audio and pro video people? I mean, they can't use iPads.
Being able to do Xcode, being able to actually build iOS apps on iOS is basically that step where it's like, okay, now we're at the point where we can build these full professional
apps. And I can see
apps.
A day where when something like that would happen. Like maybe one day I'd be like, the day I can actually connect a digital mixer like this via a lightning cable, perhaps to an iPad Pro.
Yeah, we're not even there.
No, you
can have externals, really.
Exactly. Yeah. They need to tackle all of those issues.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of work to be done, but they seem to be going there.
It's better if they tack it from the other side. I mean, we like rather than bringing, you know, OS X features to iPad. I mean, it seems like a smaller jump to make a touch interface for OS X. And like,
maybe.
I mean, like OS X, I mean, the two things that I've always seemed like really crappy design to me are the menu bar at the top and the launch pad, which is sort of like the main features of OS X.
Yeah.
Like, you know, which is totally different from iOS, but those two things, those can't.
The main problem that I have with the menu bar is that any third party app can put an icon up there and then suddenly it looks ugly as shit because your menu bar. I mean, have you ever seen screenshots of some people's menu bars where they have 50 icons
at
covering
that point,
the entire.
Just buy Bartender.
I was just going to plug Bartender. Bartender organizes it under like a three dot.
So you
menu.
Just click the Bartender and then it's got this additional
it has a drop down.
I've seen Bartender. Honestly, I feel like it. I don't understand why people like it so much. It's like polishing a turd.
I mean, yeah, it's a crutch.
You're hiding the icons, but it's not like you're not fixing the problem.
No, correct.
It's not like you can now if you could disable the menu
basically
bar.
Basically, it exposes. I mean, like all those icons and the fact that Bartender exists exposes a fundamental design problem in OS X and to me, like as soon as the IMAX got wider and wider and wider, then like all of this, you'd have an app over here and its menu bar is over here, and it's like you're breaking a fundamental law of user interface design.
Well, nobody expected 5K 27
inch
display.
But now we're there, and now we got to get rid of the stupid menu bar, and apps have to be contained the way that they are on iOS.
I agree that the software has to play catch up for sure, and they do need to put a lot of resources.
They need to make some really bold changes if they ever want it to bridge these two.
And I'm sure they've been working on it's obvious they've been working on
it.
It
has to be something they're thinking about. It absolutely has to be something.
I'm sure there are plenty
about.
Of
I mean,
like,
if we're thinking about it, they're thinking about it. So. They're not in a vacuum.
But we're writer.
The only problem
more about it.
The only problem I see with making that leap on OS X is third party apps.
Yeah. I mean, like, you'd probably do it in stages the way that Windows does. And probably what you'd end up with is.
Though they kind of botched attaching, it with eight.
Attaching the menus
to the
apps.
Window.
And, you know, basically like Windows does. And then you'd expand the sizes of menu elements, you know, until they were all touch capable.
Yeah.
And that would basically bridge you into the touch universe.
You know, they made big progress in El Capitan because you can hide the menu bar now.
Really?
Can I just say also that full screen experience in OS X is stupid?
it's not
like
great.
Everything slides over.
They improved it, but...
like the new split view is pretty cool.
Every time I do a video and then it goes full screen, but then it like, to come out of it, it slides everything over.
Some apps handle it. It makes sense for some apps. When the larger the screen, the dumber the full screen looks. Like even on this old 17-inch MacBook Pro, have you ever tried like full screening Tweetbot? on a big screen or full screening. Even Slack looks dumb. All this giant, like the message window is suddenly this big.
Yeah,
you know, it's like,
At home, I have a 27-inch Thunderbolt display, so it's like, no.
Yeah, and you know the
full screen iMessage on a Mac.
Yeah,
it's laughably
that
bad.
That is terrible.
I think the best indicator of how far OS X has fallen behind Windows, frankly, is that there's no advertising anymore from Apple that attacks Windows. They have no leg to stand on.
They don't need to though. The products. Apple's always been they like to let the product speak for itself.
Yeah, but think of for years we had this I'm a Mac, I'm a PC.
Yeah.
And none of that is valid anymore. And maybe it's just that, you know, Windows is, you know, most of that was directed at Windows Vista.
Yeah.
But they continue to enter the Windows 7 era, and now, you know, they're, you know, in a lot of ways Windows 10 is ahead.
Yeah,
but in some ways it's so far behind too. Well, like when is Microsoft like we have a whole new generation of kids that are like running Windows 10 and questioning what is this C drive? Where's A? What happened to drives A and B?
That's a very good point.
Yeah. And what about the Windows registry? Why is the Windows registry still
was
there?
Reserved for the can floppy anyone drive. Can
scientists have been unable to answer the question of why does the Windows registry
That is such a fundamental
exist?
Design problem. Like,
I know.
Seriously, why haven't they solved it? Like initially it was what, to save space? You could like load it all into memory.
So you could put flags for all your apps.
And now it's just like just
yeah.
Have apps as these single things.
You know what's funny though, with all the security enhancements and the performance enhancements and the safeguards Microsoft has put into Windows to make it
there's still
more
the
bulletproof
crap underneath.
If you go into the Windows registry even in Windows 10 and you just start randomly deleting stuff, you will completely screw up your
OS. Yeah.
Now, as opposed to OS 10 with Finder, you can delete all the plist files you want, but they'll just get regenerated the next time you open up an app. Like it's so much harder to screw up OS 10. It's not impervious, but it is so much more difficult for cruft to build up in OS 10.
From an engineering perspective, OS 10 is better designed from the ground up.
Now, let's not get it. We can have a whole debate.
I mean, like mostly
how bad HFS is as a file system, but
it's not the worst. Yeah,
but it's not the worst, but there's a lot of room for improvement.
Yeah,
but in general, I mean, mostly what we're talking about is just UI. I mean, like I don't think anyone who's an engineer would say that Windows. I don't think Windows will ever come out ahead. I mean, unless you have a long enough timeline where they can rewrite stuff, but you'd have to have, but that mostly comes from leaders. Like you have to have leaders who are willing to ditch some of the
code base. They've tried it before. There have been projects where they've tried to do new OSs.
Yeah, sure.
Like the Midori project, but
like you gotta think that like internally in Microsoft, I'm sure they've probably had this discussion that, and I'm sure somebody's brought this up about like the whole drive letter issue and the Windows registry. It's like, what is the ROI on removing it?
Yeah, and then the enterprise team goes, but we need to support all of this old stuff that our top customers have.
Right, there would be no immediate benefit, is what you're saying.
Do you think it's a possibility that Windows might eventually go more towards like a Chrome OS thing, where it's like a cloud OS? Is that even possible?
With Azure, they seem to be doing a lot more like cloud stuff. But will it ever totally replace Windows? I don't know. I think they'll probably try to bake a lot of cloud stuff into the OS, but I don't think it'll really be at a point where everything will be in the cloud.
They're going to have to address the registry because one of the things they're going to need to do is have apps that travel, essentially.
I think Windows Store apps aren't in the registry anymore. I think if you download an app directly from the Windows Store,
maybe they've already addressed it.
That's self-contained.
You know, I never understood because of the Windows platform. I've never spent the time to really understand how it works, but because I did originally use Windows for the longest time, and I remember that sometimes there were certain apps that I used where Like the best ones, my favorite ones by far are ones that did not require an installer and did not even touch the registry. Like you would have these self-executing files.
You'd be surprised.
And they would just run. Like how do those work? Like why can't you build, like I guess maybe,
you
let me pose it this way.
You don't have to use the
registry.
Can
you build a .NET app today that doesn't touch the registry? Yeah. Is it physically possible?
You don't have to use a registry. I mean, like,
so why do you need to store data like a key, like not keys, but
you don't have to.
But you're storing app preferences.
Yeah,
you're storing
key value pairs in the registry.
Right. That's the term I was looking for.
And there's no reason you do that. I mean, the only reason developers would do it now is convention and because the registry. Yeah. Is there, but there's no requirement. I mean, essentially, you can do, you know,
so
you can load a file that has key value.
So maybe where does the change need to happen? Does it need to start at the developer tools that Microsoft has, so that it doesn't compile apps that touch the registry?
The tools exist already to build apps that don't use it.
Right.
So I think,
and they always have. I mean, you could always. There was never any requirement to use
it. It's really on Microsoft to say we are phasing out the registry. Yeah. Any apps that use it must transition to using other methods.
Well, in their courses and their tools, I mean, basically guiding people to store data in a particular way, especially if they built into .NET, like here's your application store.
Yeah.
And that application store, you know, used... I mean, they probably already do something like this where it's using the local settings folder or whatever it is and not the registry. So
yeah, well, I mean, apps can have their own local database and stuff like that.
But they can't remove registry access from .NET, so they can't really prevent people from doing
that. That's a hot mess that they're going to have to deal with at some point for sure. But speaking of hot messes, though, just kind of jumping back to the OS X side of things, for the longest time, and I know a lot of people have their own gripes about Finder. Finder has more or less stayed the same with, obviously, incrementally, you know, they've added features like
tabs.
Well, it has tabs and tags now.
Yeah.
But, like, I don't like Finder, and I don't even use it all that often. And I find that I don't like to spend time. I'm so used to iOS now. I don't like spending time organizing folders and files. Like, nobody enjoys that. So what does Apple need to do about Finder?
I think internally they're attempting to reconcile, one, you do need a file system to do professional work. Like, you can't just have this random magical file container.
Well, I think, but isn't that what iCloud Drive is supposed to solve by having app data stored
in
iCloud Drive?
But it's not quite the same as a traditional file system because, like, in order to do our kind of work, like, you need to be able to create a folder where your project lives and then have subfolders for different things like CSS files, JavaScript files, etc. And you need to be able to move those files around. And you just can't do that in iOS. So they're trying to reconcile, you need to be able to do certain things in order to do professional stuff. But at the same time, traditional file systems are kind of clunky and...
Kind of clunky?
They are clunky. And
well, even
it needs to be more
system.
Like iOS.
Well, it just seems like even Apple over the last OS X revisions that they've relegated Finder to this thing that's just like there because it has to be there. But like, I don't remember what version that they did this, but a few versions ago, like for the longest time, OS X always had the Macintosh HD icon on the desktop. Then suddenly they got rid of that and you couldn't even get to Finder without clicking the Finder icon in the dock. And so
they obviously don't want
people going in there if they can avoid it. That's my impression.
Because
they don't even, even on a fresh install through the onboarding process, they don't present Finder to you.
I mean,
and now iCloud Drive is enabled by default.
Yeah.
So it's like all your app
They're starting to transition some of their apps out of Finder. Like iWork and iLife, the few remaining iLife apps, are now all in iCloud. So your Pages documents are all in iCloud. Your Numbers spreadsheets are all in iCloud. Your keynote presentations are all in iCloud. You can save to Finder, but by default now, it all goes into your iCloud drive.
See, I always thought that, so now we've made this kind of transition with iCloud drive, and I've always thought that why not, instead of having all these different folders and files in a traditional file system, why not just make, like, if everything's going to live in iCloud Drive, now obviously in Finder, you can actually go click on iCloud Drive.
Yeah.
You see all your individual app icons where it's storing their individual little data silos. But why not just make iCloud Drive the interface where you access all your files? Like, why do they need...
Well, because for one, you have to pay for it.
Yeah.
Okay, so they have to solve that problem first.
They still haven't solved the storage problem.
I mean, a lot of people have...
I keep forgetting that they still only give you 5 gigabytes of free storage. That's terrible.
And Microsoft, and here's another ups for Windows 10, is you get 1 terabyte. Yeah.
Well, it's not just Windows. Google, too, gives you copious amounts of storage space.
Yeah, like Google Photos is now, I think, unlimited. It's less than 13 megapixels.
Last time I checked, 16 gigabytes of full res photos. Beyond that, unlimited, but downsampled.
Yeah. Which is kind of crummy, but...
Hey, man. Well, but for most people, do you think they're really going to care?
Probably not, because they're taking photos with their phone.
The thing is, as an Apple customer, nobody should ever have to be concerned with losing precious family
photos. Oh, I agree.
Photos.
And that this should is, never this even is becoming pop a serious problem, especially as Apple continues to release iPhones that start at 16 gigs. Like the 6S now,
and
4K video, 12 megapixel photos. Yeah. Like at 16 gig, if you take a few videos and take a bunch of photos on a vacation,
it's absurd.
You're running out of space.
It's absurd. And, you know, it was hilarious when I actually heard some people say when app slicing came out that, oh, well, app slicing will just solve a lot of these problems and 16 gigs of
you
local
know,
storage.
Because 90% of the storage is for apps, right? No. What's on most of the storage for people's phones is photos and videos that they've taken.
But could they not with photos, if iCloud Drive is enabled, let's say they give you unlimited storage, right? Why does the local copy of that photo need to be... Why does it need
it
to remain on the device?
It
Why not just delete it immediately and just sync that copy
this,
to iCloud?
This is basically what I'd like to see happen, where they
That's
turn
what, how my phone is it?
Where they turn iCloud photo. Well, they have the optimized iPhone storage.
Yeah,
that
how
keeps
I have
a
it.
Lower quality
yeah, it's,
photo
it's not
on the iPhone.
Not quite the same way.
Then it downloads the good quality. But I'd like to see it be more like up there camera. That startup by Bertrand Serlet, who used to be at Apple. So what they've done is they've created a cloud camera where every photo you see is actually uploaded to the cloud. Like it's just on the cloud. When you take a photo, it uploads it once it's connected
to
Wi-Fi.
Just get a little thumbnail preview.
And that's it.
But that's what they're doing with their optimized...
You're still storing
a photo
on the
copy.
Phone.
It's very, very low resolution. It's got to be
it's
tiny.
Not that. It still takes up a lot, believe me. People with burst mode, people store... I look at a lot of family members' devices and they keep... going over the 5 gig. In fact, actually, most of the people I know, they're like, their photo camera roll is like at least 15 or 16
like
gigabytes.
Even if you're freeing up storage on the phone, you're still running out of storage on iCloud. So something has to
like,
give.
Yeah, I mean, they need to increase that.
Yeah.
I mean, that should be part... It should almost be part of the service of the phone.
Apple has within
I mean,
their power.
You're buying a $900 phone. I think they can give you more than 5 gigs.
It should just be one
of
the go-along, you know, features of the iPhone is that you can store all your photos and videos. I mean, I think they should at least give you a terabyte up front. Like, I'm trying to monetize the storage. Like,
it's not worth it for them. It's peanuts.
Yeah.
It's not worth
it. Yeah, and
they
all
need
of their
to just realize that because they're losing good customer goodwill by allowing people to lose their photos.
Yeah, because people are seeing these errors and then they're going, well, how can I stop this? And then they go to Google Photos or they go to Dropbox.
I watched my dad for the longest time. Every week, feverishly deleting photos because he's going over his 5 gigs and he refuses to pay money to upgrade.
Yeah.
So it's like, people shouldn't have to deal with this.
No, they shouldn't.
Or they just don't even understand. Like, I mean, I talk to family members and they're like, why do I need this? And, you know, when you explain it to pay for it, they're like, why would I have to pay, you know, to...
Exactly, exactly. And what a lot of people don't even realize what is actually consuming space on their device. Like my dad's asked me many times, I thought I deleted all these photos. Where's the space coming from? And he didn't know where to go in settings to... Because, of course, they bury this menu in settings to go look at what is actually consuming your storage space. And, of course, he had a bunch of videos that were taking up a crap load of space. Even with videos, just upload them to the cloud and just delete the local copy off the device. Then maybe 16 gigs might be okay if like all that stuff lives on the cloud, basically.
Yeah.
But what's that other, that smartphone company? Is it Robin?
NextBit. The phone is called the Robin, but the company's NextBit. Okay.
So that's basically what they want to do, right?
Yeah. With their their concept is that everything on your phone lives in the cloud. And when you need to use an app, it downloads it and opens it. And when you haven't used apps for a while, it deletes them off the phone, but still keeps the icon there. And then when you want to use it, it re-downloads it with all of your settings intact.
We've reached a point where everybody pretty much has fast broadband on their phone. Oftentimes, LTE is faster than what they have.
Though, I mean, with this kind of thing, you don't want to run into your data cap. So, I mean, for a lot of it, you'll want to be at a Wi-Fi hotspot.
Yeah, you suddenly try to do an app, and all of a sudden, it's not really there.
Yeah,
that's not. I don't see that as a big roadblock, though.
But this is what I'm saying, that just to get back to on the desktop, I think that Windows could start doing that with their apps, like something similar where, wherever you go, there's your app, and if you don't use it, just take it back off. You download it in 2 seconds from the Windows App Store.
What's Microsoft's Photos storage solution for Windows PCs and Windows Phone? Do they have any kind of cloud?
Through OneDrive. It does a similar thing to Dropbox and all
theirs
of those.
Theirs is awesome.
Yeah. Does it store the local copy of the photo on the device, or does it do
I think it's in your OneDrive folder, but your OneDrive folder is like a Dropbox folder, except I don't know if it still keeps it locally or not. I think it does.
I don't. Like in the app, it doesn't.
No,
because it wouldn't. It doesn't in the app, you're actually downloading each time.
Yeah, because the Dropbox app, obviously, it doesn't store.
I think
everything.
OneDrive works like Google Drive does on the desktop, and it actually doesn't store anything. So it doesn't even it may store the thumb. It probably for
there's some kind of cache.
It's going to store thumbnails or something.
Okay,
but I think all of your files and all of your photos maybe don't actually exist on the device.
No photo.
Maybe it's like Dropbox where they do.
I think it's like Dropbox. I'd have to check, copied. But I think it's like Dropbox.
But their photo thing is cool because, unlike iCloud photos, you can easily share Microsoft the OneDrive photos, and they have great great facial recognition built into their web interface and stuff like that.
So. Yeah, that's another issue. There are a couple of sore spots for the Photos app and the service and how it works, because this is where we get into a kind of a trade-off, I guess, with functionality and security. Because on the one hand, Google's photo service is amazing because they use all of their algorithms and data that they collect from you to just kind of like magically make it work, so that if you want to type in the word snow, it'll automatically show you all the photos that contain the word snow because it's analyzing all this stuff. But Apple, of course, can't do this because they don't want or don't have access to that kind of, they don't have access to that data. But with photos, I did a fresh install of OS X not too long ago, and I was not pleased with the experience that I had, because as soon as you open the app and it logs into iCloud, it starts downloading your entire photo album, which makes the CPU on my Mac spin. And the way it by default is set up is that it downloads the full resolution version, and my photo library is like 25 gigabytes, so it takes all day. It's like, why is this the default? You don't need to download all of those photos to my hard drive.
I think they'll probably put it as the default will be the optimized.
I hope eventually, at the very least, because that's crazy.
I think they're starting with the switchover, and the problem is, and people are used to, the desktop being the center, and they're just starting to migrate to iCloud is sort of your central hub of, you know, like your data and your apps. They're just not quite there yet. They're still centered around the desktop computer.
Right. Yeah. Well, and maybe they wanted to perhaps allow iCloud Drive and the CloudKit API to sort of give it some breathing room to fully get out there and really make sure that it's actually rock solid, because it's had such a tumultuous history.
From what I've heard from developers, it is pretty solid. Like they did manage to knock CloudKit out of the park the first try. It just works. Like
it pretty much has been reliable.
Unlike the previous iCloud API that developers were using, which was terrible and worked maybe 60% of the time, the CloudKit API is really solid.
With CloudKit, they got rid of the key value pair of sync stuff. Right?
Yeah, it's now a more traditional REST API, I think. So now it behaves more like an actual service than a weird magic box that you throw data into and hope it shows up on the other side, which is what the first API was. Like, developers would literally just throw their data into this magic box and they'd be like, well, I hope it gets there. And a lot of the time it didn't. But this CloudKit API is a lot like a traditional data API in that you send something and it goes, yes, I got it. And you're like, cool. And then when you load the app on another device, it goes, hey, is there new stuff? It goes, yeah, here it is.
Yeah.
Like it's what they should have done the first time, but didn't for whatever reason. Like they forgot how to do data services or something. I don't know. But yeah.
We should probably wrap where you just surpassed the 2-hour mark.
Yeah. we've talked for a while.
Well, Matt, thank you very much for joining us today. Is there anything that you want to plug? I understand you've done some podcasting yourself.
Yeah, I have, but I don't have a current podcast going. I can plug my friends, who, you know, the League of Man Children. They do a lot of podcasts over there. And I could plug my current project that I'm plugging, which is Crunch 2, which is at getcrunch.co is the website for that.
Fantastic. So I'm sure plenty of web developers listen to this show, since we're partly a technology show. So if you are a web developer, go check out that app
and download it.
And download it.
And buy that Crunch was Pro.
And then buy Crunch Pro.
And also designed by you, Michael, right?
Yes.
That's right. Why didn't I plug you?
Yeah. with Matt's help over many design sessions,
yeah, that's right,
we came up with the Crunch 2 UI.
Yeah.
And the wonderful awesomeness that is Magic Tabs.
That was, you know, that's a story in itself for another day, because that took a lot of, that was a long process to get there.
Yeah. We should do a case study.
Well, you're certainly welcome to come back and talk about Magic Tabs.
All right. Will do.
You've been listening to The Impromptu on Hologram Radio. I'm Alex Knight, and joined by Michael Norton, as always, and Matt Dean. If you'd like to support the show, you can go to our Patreon page, which is reasonably new, at patreon.com/hologramradio. You can also show your support by subscribing to the show in iTunes, which is the best way to make sure that you get every single episode every week in your podcast app of choice. And if you're in iTunes, why not leave us a rating or comment? That is actually a great way for new people to discover the show. Another way you can support the show is by going to hologramradio.org/sponsors. We have Amazon links for Amazon UK, USA, and Canada. And everyone shops at Amazon. I know Michael shops at Amazon, and so do I. And we seem to be spending less and less time in retail stores these days. There's no added work needed on your part, so why not just click on one of those affiliate banner links, and every time you make a purchase, we get a portion of the sale, which helps us cover our operational costs. You can follow the show on Twitter. We're individually at Zen Impulse, which is Michael Norton, and I am at Zero Distraction. And Matt, do you have a Twitter account?
Matthew Dieners.
There you go. We're also at The Impromptu on Twitter, and our Hologram Radio accounts on Facebook at facebook.com/hologramradio, and now also on Instagram at Hologram Radio Shows, because some big jerk took Hologram Radio. Even though that account has been deleted, you cannot get that name back. unfortunately.
Son of a bitch.
And if you'd like to drop us a line and give us some feedback on the show, send an email to theimpromptu@hologramradio.org. And that's it for now.
And on that note, thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time.